first of all, thank you, Dick. It's a pleasure to be here, and your timing is impeccable. I'll explain why that's true. I think you could say fairly that this is maybe the first time in human history that we're actually talking about eradicating hunger in the world. And that's explicit in the Sustainable Development Goals that were adopted last year by the global community. And I guess a couple thoughts on that. One is, and especially coming from a development agency like USAID, we kind of have to start where we are. In other words, we've got to take care of people who are hungry now and move towards that goal, prioritizing those who are most at risk, the most undernourished, et cetera. But I think in doing that, we can keep a longer term in view. And this is particularly relevant in science, where some of the things we want to do in the nearer to medium term can be done much more effectively, or maybe might not be able to be done at all without good science, including advanced research approaches. And then on the other hand, I find in the community, like in NSF or BBSRC, the British Biotechnology Research Council, there's a hunger on the part of the basic research community also to connect to what we're doing to fight hunger on the ground. So I think keeping that sort of upstream and downstream linkage and that connection between the individual level outcomes in terms of people with global outcomes in terms of the major global issues facing the world is something I'd like you to try to think about as we go forward here. So, there is good news. Poverty and hunger are declining. We met the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals. We've got the reintegration of agriculture and nutrition in Feed the Future. That's the U.S. government's food security program. And I think it's important to remember that Congress gives us this money not because they love research, for example. They give it to us to reduce hunger, reduce child stunting, and reduce extreme poverty that go along with those. And so we have those high-level outcomes that we always have to keep in view. And child stunting in particular is a challenging one if you're investing in ag research, but I'll say more about that in a bit. But I think the Sustainable Development Goal 2 about eradicating hunger and undernutrition, malnutrition, is a huge signal that we have to make use of. And then most recently, this summer, President Obama signed, after the Congress passed by huge margins, the Global Food Security Act of 2016, which essentially builds on the progress made over the last 7 years that Dick referred to, but introduces some new ideas as well. Water and sanitation is included now explicitly, and I think that's largely around that stunting objective. Also, the idea of resilience. You know, Congress is saying, look, you're always doing all this emergency stuff in the Horn of Africa and the Sahel. Isn't there a way that we can do that better so that that's integrated with our larger efforts around food security and extreme poverty? And I think also the concept that's dominating there is that no one should be left behind. So what do we do? This is just a quick list of what we do in Feed the Future. I highlighted R&D because I actually, this might be my own lens, but I feel that R&D helps us do all the rest of these well as well. And I don't mean just biophysical R&D. This could be social science. It can be economics and policy research. But I do feel it's pivotal that innovation that comes out of the applications of R&D are pivotal in moving us forward, and that's, I think, will be the heart of what I'll be talking to you about. So, as you can see, poverty and hunger have declined. There's a really nice drop in terms of undernourishment, in terms of percentage, not necessarily in absolute terms, depending on population growth. But you can see it going down almost everywhere, not as fast in Africa as we'd like, but look at on the right, the poverty line for Africa is pretty flat, so that's not encouraging. But in other regions of the world, we are bringing down this extreme poverty level. But at the bottom of the slide, you'll see that the marker for micronutrient malnutrition, which is sometimes called hidden hunger, but its effects are not hidden. They can be quite pernicious. This is basically a signal around diet quality and other issues that affect particularly children's, but also the broader population's ability to thrive. And I think, you know, while this is encouraging that we're going the right direction, we still have more than 3 million children a year dying from causes related to undernutrition, not enough food, not enough quality food in their diets. And so, you know, the urgency is absolutely still there. There's no time for complacency. So if we then look at this in terms of where we are, you're familiar with this kind of list. There's nothing new there, really. In fact, I could have put this up 10 or 15 years ago, and at that time, there was very little interest in investing in agriculture and food in the developing world. We knew all of these things were happening. And yet, what happened was in 2008, we had an enormous price spike rise in global foods led by the major cereals, but with a lot of knock-on effects into other commodities. And you can see some of the modeling that's been done at the Food Policy Research Institute by Mark Rosegrant suggests that an era of higher prices is here to stay. Now, I know that we've had some decline in prices in the last couple years, and there has been a huge supply response, which I'll say more about, to the high prices, but that comes at a cost. So in thinking about what's driving this, there's really a couple of things. One is fairly obvious, and that is the growth of incomes in so much of the world as people shift to more cereal-intensive diets. They want more animal-source foods. They want foods that have been fed corn and soybeans. And so the demand for food was growing much more rapidly than the population. Or, and this is the more insidious piece, the productivity gains that we were seeing. This is some Ken Kassman, if you've heard him, often speaks about this. But basically, we've had a linear rate of growth since the beginning of the Green Revolution in our three major cereals. Year-on-year increment about the same for 40, 50 years. What that has meant is a declining rate of productivity growth from almost 3% in the early days of the Green Revolution to about 1% now. And that change in productivity gain has a lot of implications for affordability of food, availability of food, the benefits that come from agricultural growth. And agricultural growth has some unique features that I'll mention to you. But as you can see, what we need to do is we need to get that slope more steeper. We've got to see if we can re-energize productivity growth, and there are many reasons for that across the board. So here's a summary slide from IFPRI, which talks about the various challenges: climate, water scarcity, growing biofuel demand, the whole list that drives higher food prices. But also there, notice the growing threat to lands, biodiversity, water, environmental conservation. This is a really big issue, and it's one where I feel like our community needs to do a better job communicating to the global community, and particularly the global environmental community, because what we've got to do is figure out a way to drive total factor productivity gains on good lands to help spare more fragile environments. And I think that's illustrated really nicely here. This demand growth that started in the early part of the last decade is fueling about 10 million hectares of land conversion a year, or additional land coming into agriculture, after having been mostly flat for 20 years beforehand. So that land, that's when I said earlier, it comes at a cost. Depending where that land is, that land can be threatening more fragile environments, tropical forest areas, wetlands, hillsides, areas that aren't going to be as productive or robust under the plow. And you can see that about three-fifths of that, 6 million hectares a year, is being driven by rice, wheat, and maize alone. And if you threw in soy, you'd probably get another 20%. So, you know, what happens in agriculture matters for the global environment, and that's something that we somehow need to do a better job of communicating to the global community. Now, a little bit about why agriculture, okay? We don't do it because we care about the environment, right? I mean, we do it for many reasons, but look at the the poverty growth elasticities here. Agricultural growth is extremely effective at driving down poverty. And you can see here, this is still the case. This has been known for many years, but it is also the case in still in more recent data coming out of sub-Saharan Africa. It's about twice as effective as urban growth. And Zambia is a bit of an outlier, but it also has a very different economy where mining is very dominant. But I think the issue here is that agricultural growth, as opposed to urban growth, generates the demand for locally produced goods and services. And these are goods and services that the poor are better positioned to benefit from in terms of job opportunities and employment. So it's very effective, whereas urban growth tends to drive growth in imports, which has very little way in terms of environmental linkages in the economy. But then what about hunger? Well, we see the same thing, that agricultural growth, especially in your staples and in your pulses and things like this, are especially effective in driving down hunger. There's a high degree of, as you make productivity gains in these commodities, you see reductions in undernutrition that are significant. And all of the livestock does well, as also not as well as the cereals and legumes. But again, the idea here is that these are widely produced commodities and widely consumed, and with productivity growth, they become more available and more affordable. So consumers benefit and producers benefit through these gains. Now, what about nutrition? Because this is just under caloric nutrition. But we know there's more than that. And this is where I'd like to say a little bit about the stunting challenge that I mentioned there. So if we look at this, if this is a what's contributing to nutrition outcomes globally, food's about a third. But look at that. The dark green is staples, calories. But the light green is actually from diverse quality foods in the diet, animal-sourced foods, fruits and vegetables, and so forth. Water and sanitation, also about a third. And then finally, women's education and women's status, which is a marker for all kinds of things having to do with decision-making in the household, knowledge about care, hygiene, access to health care. All of these things track very strongly with the status of women and the education of women. So that's, I think, something that tells us that if we really want to deliver on what Congress is asking us to do, we've got to figure out a way to work in an integrated fashion that takes into account this approach. And this is what the new Global Food Security Act of 2016 asks us to do. So let's turn now to the research programs that we've been doing under Feed the Future. We basically have three long-term research programs: climate resilient cereals, advanced approaches to pests and diseases on plants and livestock, crops and livestock, and productive legumes. And then we have three sort of medium-term cross-cutting programs on nutritious and safe foods, policy, and also human and institutional capacity building, coming together around an integrating program that we're going to hear more about today, which is sustainable intensification, where both the technologies and the policies and the human capacity and the knowledge base all come together to deliver agricultural transformation. And then I want to say a little bit before we go into the program on who we work with and how. I hope many of you may have heard of the Feed the Future Innovation Labs. These are 24 university-led programs, but they engage about 65 universities and at least as many, far more actually, overseas partner institutions. And this is a means by which we're able to leverage U.S. capacity. Many of these programs do sub-granting, and it's all competitively run. You can see they're covering a number of important areas, and it's a way for us, I think, to build on USDA investments in the universities, NSF investments in the universities, but also your state investments and commodity groups, and many of those innovation labs involve people from commodity groups on their boards and so forth. So we look at it as a really unique way to leverage, but also to build capacity by using the capacities of our U.S. universities in collaborative research partnerships. And then the CGIAR system, I think probably most of you are familiar with this. What I'd like to think is that we have moved away from what I used to call a lumpy portfolio, where we had the CG here and the universities here and some biotech with the private sector over here. And instead, we're using these thematic research programs that I mentioned to link together those partners in ways that exploit and take advantage of and their respective strengths, and also where they complement each other. So more and more you're going to hear me talking about alliances between a CG center, a U.S. university, and a national program or the private sector. And a little bit just before we go on to the research area, recognizing that, you know, we are not a research organization per se, but what we can do is build on this incredible investment base that our sister agencies have done, really take through this translational into application space, and that's also very important to us. And I feel like more and more some of the really big ticket things we want to do in terms of climate resilience or water use efficiency or photosynthetic efficiency, it's going to require those kinds of partnerships that link together the development outcomes with those who are looking 10, 20, 30 years ahead, not 5 years ahead. So starting with climate resilience cereals, our biggest program, this just gives you an idea of what the programs we have with the U.S. universities. But in a nutshell, there's one or two that are value chain oriented, but in a nutshell, they're really about trying to accelerate breeding gains, so genomic selection, improved phenotyping. These are things where we can leverage our capacity into international programs that are aligned. And a nice example is this work from South Asia, where we have Purdue, CIMMYT, and a national program, public and private partners from four countries. And in 3 years, we have made incredible progress using genomic selection and other rapid approaches on heat-tolerant maize. Similarly, we have a major partnership in sub-Saharan Africa on climate-resilient maize that is more resistant or more tolerant of drought. And that, in this last El Nino, I don't have good data yet, but we certainly have some anecdotal evidence to show that farmers who were growing these climate-resilient varieties were better off than those who had not adopted. So, you know, we're still learning in this whole area of abiotic stress, but we're moving. And legume productivity, legumes are beautiful crops, and I suspect Sig is going to say more about that. But we love them because they're nutritious. They fetch a good price. They generate income, especially for women. And, of course, they confer environmental benefits. But they're also subject to many of the problems that cereals have. And unlike cereals, they haven't had the same level of investment. So we really want to see how we can up the level of productivity gains. And we know this is possible because we've seen it happen in soy, where you have had a lot of investment in research. So here we are with our university partners, and they're really working on foundational areas, Doug Cook's lab to broaden the chickpea germplasm base, climate-resilient cowpea at Riverside, a lab at Penn State working on beans and disease resistance, and then pigeon pea genomics. So we're trying to bring in some tools that really haven't been so leveraged for these particular kinds of crops. Of course, advanced approaches, these are some of the places where USDA and U.S. universities have capacity that can be leveraged in, even if we don't have major programs. Like, we may not have a major program on East Coast fever in the United States, but we can have a platform for vaccine development. Same thing on cassava. We can have diseases of cassava where we can bring in the scientific capacity, even if we don't have a cassava program per se in the United States. And then, of course, in some of these things we deal with defy traditional approaches because we don't have variability in the germplasm. So here in this situation, we are using transgenics. And I'm pleased to say that one of these has been commercialized and released in Bangladesh, the insect-resistant eggplant, which is a beautiful technology that obviates about 90% of the need for spraying, has huge environmental gains, food safety gains, as well as income gains and consumer gains. So we're very excited about that. And alongside doing that, you need to also then build science-based regulatory capacity. Nutritious and safe foods, this would be our animal source foods, horticulture, things like reducing aflatoxin, and of course diet quality, including through biofortified foods. And now to the sustainable intensification, and I'm just going to use one quick example. This is a woman in Malawi who 20 years ago was getting about 2 bags of maize off her half hectare. And then she, even if she used fertilizer, she was getting a miserable return. And she started integrating Federbia, a nitrogen-fixing tree, and she has now totally changed her life over time by diversifying, but especially by getting nitrogen and biomass into that soil. And she now gets about 50 bags of maize on the same land. She uses fertilizers, but she gets a huge return on them as opposed to before. They're subsidized in Malawi. And then she has, selling some of that maize, she's built a house, she's bought livestock, goats and pigs, and she has money for school fees. So this is the kind of the human face of what I talk about when I say sustainable intensification and using our land that we have in a more productive, sustainably productive way that can generate the kinds of livelihoods that put people on a new path where her children, for example, are going to be going to school probably for the first time. I want to say a little bit about climate smart agriculture. We hear a lot about this. In my opinion, I mean, a lot of what we want to do in sustainable intensification is climate smart, because it's about increasing total factor productivity. It's about reducing risk, including climate risk, to help foster investment at all levels, off-farm and on-farm. So much of what we do to adapt agriculture to climate change actually involves biomass and carbon and nutrient cycling and all the things that people who want to do mitigation would like to do if they were looking for ways to increase soil organic matter, for example, as a source of sequestering carbon. It's all about prudent and efficient use of inputs, but it is about using them. Okay, this is not about keeping poor African farmers poor. We want them to have access to irrigation, mechanization, fertilizers, and diversified technologies and the knowledge that goes with using those. So it is information intensive, and I think there's a lot of excitement that we can tap into there, whether it's handheld phones that give you the better weather information, market information. Just think how empowering it is to know what the price in the long way is if you're sitting 100 kilometers away for the product you're selling. It really empowers the producer community. And what we find very much is that what we want to do for food security and climate smart ag is completely aligned with what we want to do for either environmental drivers or, more surprisingly perhaps, profitability drivers. So this is about sustainability, productivity, going together with adaptation and mitigation, the three pillars of climate smart agriculture. So really what we want to do is bend the curve in a lot of places in Africa in terms of a low emissions development. In parts of South Asia, this is some work done from CISA that JK is here and others that have been involved with this in South Asia, where we're in a system that's already intensified, but using conservation agriculture, diversification, and precision agriculture, laser land leveling, things like that, we can really drive down the energy use. We can drive way up the irrigation efficiency. When you drive that up, you can drive down the need to be pumping as much water, so there's a big savings in energy there, as well as and costs and greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, profitability goes up. So again, it's this very attractive, climate resilient system that depends on excellent management of the resource, but also access to really good technologies, be they flood tolerant rice, stress tolerant, heat tolerant wheats, a big issue in South Asia, the early onset of heat. So it's really about, I think, giving farmers choices and better choices that they then can decide what works for them. So the second area that, if I sum this up in terms of a strategic area, one is to leverage the genetics and that the new science there, but the second is really to figure out how to close this yield gap. And of course, our actual field gaps are much larger than the way that portrays it, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. But it has a global outcome attached to it that plays out at the local level in terms of poverty and income, but at the global level in terms of how much of our land we conserve as forests, woodlands, and wetlands. But there's a whole lot of data approaches and new tools here that can help us understand, by characterizing soils, fertilizer response, weather, markets, that can help improve decision-making so that we have a better strategy for decision-making around research and around development. I don't like to speak without saying something about this, the fact that we desperately still need irrigation, mechanization, and fertilizer in these systems in the world. I got pretty annoyed a couple years ago in New York at the Climate Smart Agriculture meetings. They had all these people smiling with short-handle hose, you know, and I thought, boy, you know, that is not an easy way to make a living, you know, if you're trying to feed yourself with a short-handle hoe. I mean, we got to get past that. It's not going to be competitive anyway. So a lot of what we need to figure out how to do, and this is where innovation and science is so important, is figure out how to drive down risk, drive up productivity so as to attract investment, whether it's on-farm or off-farm. So really getting the risk under control. And so there's many pieces of that, but certainly this piece is essential if we're going to get the kinds of returns to land, labor, and capital. So figuring out how to capitalize these undercapitalized systems, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. In Asia, they're, most places they're further out, but they still, there's huge transformative gains. This man, I think, is in Cambodia. There's going to be huge transformative gains there when they get irrigation. They still don't have much area, and they have the potential for it. And Africa has a lot of potential for irrigation. It's only beginning to be explored, but it's going to be a huge part of Africa's emerging as a global breadbasket, in my opinion. And I think there's, you know, other people writing and speaking about this who are thinking very much about the role of water and irrigation in that. On the nitrogen, I'd like to show this slide just because, you know, you can't believe how many people think fertilizer's bad. You know, and look at Africa. I mean, they hardly use it. That has to change. Now, we don't have to make the same mistakes that have been made in China or parts of South Asia or other parts of the world where it's been too intensely used and wastefully used. So we can be strategic and smart about it. I think we're going to hear more about that. But it is a critical piece that is to stop the soil mining and to help drive the goals that Africa's own leaders have set for themselves. They want to double agricultural productivity by 2025. Not going to happen without fertilizer. So economic drivers, just to say that, you know, even the best technology in a lousy policy environment is constrained. So we don't not think about this. We do have policy research, and we do have good economic and social science minds thinking about ways to mitigate risk, make finance more available, capitalize undercapitalized systems. A little bit just on capacity building, saying we work individual levels, institutional, especially trying to think about how to drive institutional change if we're really interested in sustainability of these investments. And that's, I think, one of the objectives where we hope we're going to try to figure out how to make the whole greater than the sum of the part with our university programs. So this is my breeding checklist, or my checklist for the field book. So it's the new science, reducing the yield gaps, choices. It's not for us to tell people what to do. We need to try to develop choices that work for them. Resource use efficiency, diversification, yes, but not de-linked from productivity of the staple, which drives diversification. A person in Malawi, until they're sure they're going to have enough maize or be able to buy it at a decent price, is not going to stop planting their land to maize and start doing other things. They might, maybe we'll hear some more about how they might integrate some things to help make that, but that's where we want to go. Policies, infrastructure, critical, and of course metrics. I can't tell you how important it's been to be able to talk about our achievements, and we really have the data now showing that we are driving population level reductions in poverty and stunting. So I think I'm out of time, but thank you all very much.